Everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Daily Wisdom Words podcast, where every week we're in conversation with folks who have stories, advice, and life hacks, all of which take you one step closer to that feeling of hope. I'm your host, Neil Chiaretti, and I'm so glad today. It's such a pleasure to be joined by best-selling author, teacher, and a role model, I'm sure, to so many women out there struggling with eating disorders. So proud to welcome Brooke Heberling. Hey, Brooke, welcome to the show.
Hey, Neil. Thank you so much for having me. I'm just thrilled to be here. Your podcast does such amazing work with giving people, like you said in the intro, hope. And I'm excited to tell my story and hopefully spark some of that in your audience as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start with, the story itself, the main thing, I'm sure, which a lot of people, tell us a little bit about your background and how your struggles started and what forms it took.
So ironically, we talked off air that we're recording this during actual Eating Disorder Awareness, National Eating Disorder Awareness Week. But as you so brilliantly said, you know, it's such a great topic that so many people suffer, and we need to bring it up so much more than once, 1 week a year. So I really appreciate you helping getting this type of awareness out there. I am a 38-year-old, almost 39-year-old teacher. I grew up in the 90s, like, or 80s, 90s kid. And I think a lot of people in this age and stage range can attest to the type of childhood that, you know, media was exposing at that time, the beauty standards, the also the unrealistic fear of quote unquote fat lipids and actual food. And all the diet trends that came around. And I was in a household that my mom and my aunts and my uncles, and, you know, my whole family, we talked about that stuff, and it was open dialogue, the diet trends and body and what societal standards are, whether it was good or bad. It was definitely a conversation in my household often. So I grew up just with a hyper awareness. I am an empath, self-professed empath. I'm a big time feeler, which a lot of us that suffer from mental illness and different depressions, anxieties, I think we can all classify ourselves as that.
Definitely.
In a way, shape, or form. But I started having signs of anxiety when I was like super young. It manifested itself in my sleep patterns. So I did not sleep well. I had insomnia, stomach aches, all the type of things that we now in our wisdom of the two 2020s of anxiety and depression of what that looks like. It's not just crying or shaking, you know, it manifests itself in so many ways. And my anxiety came out and it at night, big time. So with not armed with a lot of wisdom or experience with anxiety, my parents, it just kind of went over their heads. It just wasn't a buzzword at the time. People weren't diagnosing it or talking about it as much openly as we are today. And I was kind of that kid that fell through the cracks. And I kind of got in with the wrong crowd. When I say the wrong crowd, I guess it was I already had this predisposition for anxiety, depression, and low self-esteem because of just my chemical imbalance, but also with my family dynamics and stuff and people focusing on body and there being societal standards were upheld in my household. So little comments, little things, and not meaning to be harmful, but you know, that me as an empath took straight to heart and straight to, okay, this is not just a criticism. This is not just a suggestion. This is a rule. So yeah. Like when, so I just had, that was kind of the environment, very much so hyper-focused on body health, perfection, and also people pleasing, just right. not being too much of a burden
yeah.
on anyone or anything around me. And then right. I met a boy who was he was into bodybuilding and he was into weightlifting and in competitions and that kind of stuff. So I already had this predisposition. Then I had this this group of people come into my life that was just escalating the importance even more of body, working out, what you put in your body and how you eat, and basically putting a moral code and moral value to how what you put in your body and how you worked it out. And then yeah. also like how you looked, how you dressed, and all that. So unfortunately, I bought in hook, line, and sinker and led the path in many of the ways of the group, admittedly. And I decided, or I didn't decide, I kind of learned some purging behaviors that were not healthy at all. Okay. Yeah. Like, and when I say purging behaviors, I was clinically diagnosed as anorexic with purging tendencies. And just so if you do, an anorexia is basically, for people that might not know, is you have kind of like a fear of eating. It's not, it really doesn't even have to do with body size. A lot of people think that anorexics are only these, like one type that fit into this certain mold of what a woman or man would look like anorexic, but that's not true. You can be anorexic at any size. If you are not fueling your body properly, consistently due to fears within and feeling not worthy and not good enough or not, I often call it like, I felt like I was above the curve. I didn't need, like, everybody needed nutrition like this, but I'm here. I don't need it like everybody else. I my body functions differently than what science says. You know, right. My body functions differently than what everybody says is healthy or balanced. My ego inflated this, these behaviors of restricting food or purging food. Like I said, purging, it doesn't mean there's many ways to purge food. And I don't want to trigger anybody, so I won't go into like super details, but it's not only one way. And one of my purging tendencies was running. And so if I were to allow myself to consume the calories that my body needed, I would then use them up as best as I could in a calculated way. So my poor body was always working at a deficit and in starvation mode. So I kind of have hit the gamut of using, I guess I could be, I have dabbled in all the areas that one can dabble in, food restriction, body restriction, and pushing yourself to the limit. Right. And it's interesting because I'm going to be honest, it worked for me for a while. And yeah. I think that's why we all start doing these coping mechanisms that we know are not healthy, because in the beginning, it doesn't hurt us as much as it helps us.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it doesn't hurt you, but in not saying help as in, like literally it's good for you, but in your brain, you use these behaviors and then your mind is freed, right? For that. Yeah,
is it almost like any addiction? Like, you know, when people take their first joint or their first shot of whiskey or whatever, or their first cigarette, and it's not as if you take one for the first time and boom, your life is over, all your brain's up. It, the first time, it always feels good. It's like, I want more of this, right? So is the process similar to that?
And that, yes, and you hit the nail on the head, is that that's exactly what addiction and what these behaviors, whether it's an eating disorder behavior or an addictive behavior, anything, it just, it's like a, you know, a growing water stain, right? Yeah. You see this little spot and you're like, oh, it's fine. It's fine. There's just that little spot. Like, nobody will notice. It'll be fine. Then it grows and it grows. And then all of a sudden your house is caving in because you didn't pay attention to that little spot that was your first red flag of like, hey, we've got something going on here, right? So I was a mastermind, which many of us people that suffer with eating disorders are. I was a mastermind at hiding my symptoms. I often describe it as I was playing a game of whack-a-mole. So if I had my three favorite ways to use my eating disorder behaviors, running, purging, and restricting. So I would do one until somebody would say something that loved me or cared about me. I'm like, hey, I see you. You're not eating as much. Like, is everything okay? I'm like, whoop, gotta start eating. Then I'm like, well, gotta run more. Then whoop, gotta do this. So it was us playing this terrible like roulette with my health and with my body, and I'll pause right there. I started my behaviors when I was 14 15. I am now 38 and I'm paying for it. So I guess to any of the young listeners or people that are thinking that, oh, like, I'm in my prime. Like, if I do this now, later, like, it won't matter because my body is this. I abused my body from the age of 16 till I was 31. And where I should, I am privileged to reside in a small body frame and have very healthy genetics when it comes to my heart and all that stuff. I should be super thriving in my health right now. Yet I'm 39. I have sleep apnea from all the abuse of not nurturing my body. I broke my back while I was overrunning. I never got it fixed properly because I wanted to keep running. And I'm still having to go to the chiropractor now weekly just for pain, to manage pain and stuff. And it's so many, my bowel system, we don't even want to go there. And the reason I say these things is because it's so easy when you see that little water stain and you're getting those results of calming the anxiety. Or if we're talking about like people that are on journeys with their body, like you see the results that you want and you're like, oh yes, that works. But you also have to understand, like, we're in this body. We have this one body in this lifetime. Like, this is all we get. And to number one, waste time hating ourselves for things that we cannot change.
Right.
And two, trying to using up all our precious time on this earth to manipulate the vessel we're in, we never get to enjoy the journey, right?
So true.
And so it's sad for me because especially this time of year, listening to the diet talk and listening to the people churning religious practices into a way to lose weight or just give up a vice that has nothing to do with your relationship with your spiritual being. Like, it's frustrating. And I was a part of that for so long. So I suffered and was in this diet culture, thinking my worth came from how I looked and what my body could do, whether that was athletic wise or be attractive, bring people in. I thrived off that because I really didn't put much worth in who I was as a person. Yeah. Which makes me sad now, because now I know I'm such a wonderful human, that I'm such a person to know and love. And I wish I would have known that about myself long, long ago, you know? Yeah. So how this all came to a head, I did my whack-a-mole game with my different eating disorders, and my different behaviors that I was using. And, I got pregnant without having a period, because, and also for your listeners, the first thing that when you're not nourishing your body properly, the first thing that's going to go are your unnecessary functions. So the ones that are not keeping you alive. So in women, that's often your reproductive system just kind of shuts down and says, sorry, your body says, sorry, uterus, like, you can't get any food this week because old heart is struggling over there. Right.
Yeah.
So it was a miracle that I even got pregnant, twice. And, I was disordered through both my pregnancies, which is hard to admit. And I have a saying, if you own your stuff, no one can hold it against you. And that's how I work. So yes, it was horrible. I was disordered. I didn't nourish my body properly. I was over-exercising, running marathons while not feeling my body properly, while trying to grow a baby and all that stuff. So God knew I needed these two children, and I'm so thankful that I had healthy births and pregnancies. So then I had these two babies on top of struggling with my mental illness, having a full-time job as a teacher, being a wife, being a sister, being a friend, all that stuff. I really never gave women credit until I became one, of like everything, and not only women, just people in general, that they have to, like, we have to juggle 18 million things.
Yeah.
I remember being very critical of that as I was younger, of like, oh, I'll be able to handle everything. And it's funny, not funny, because my parents still, people will come to me now as a mom, my son's 11 now and my daughter's 9, and they'll say, man, like, you handled it so well. How'd you make it? I was like, do y'all remember in 2016 when homegirl went down? I went down because my daughter was 2, my son was 4. I'd been trying to juggle all those things for 4 years, while not fueling myself, while not pouring into myself, while not honoring my body. And my heart started to give out. I think that's the biggest misconception. A big misconception, that people, there's two very distinct ways people often pass from an eating disorder, and one is heart failure and the other is suicide by suicide. And it's sad, because when my heart started failing, I was marathon training, and I went to a cardiologist because I was having to get up in the middle of the night and I felt my heart stopping and I would have to get up and do jumping jacks. And I knew my pulse was really, really low. So I went to a doctor and got on a stress test. And I won't go, I never go into numbers, but I was the winner of how long that it took me to run on the treadmill to get to my heartbeat up to 165 beats per minute because my heart was sick.
Wow.
So instead of telling me, ma'am, we think you might have a problem, we need to look at this, they took a picture of me and put me on their wall as the like athletic heart of the century. And I walked out of there, my husband, who was encouraging me to get help, I walked out of there, I was like, I'm an athlete. Like, I'm on the wall. Like, I don't need to do anything. Like, I am fine. And he's like, Brooke, like, you were, like, it is not. And so my heart average at rest was 33 beats per minute.
Wow, that's slow.
Which is half of what a lower normal heartbeat should be. And finally, I was scared enough myself that I got a heart monitor. We looked at it and then I got into counseling because everyone around me was very aware that this was an eating disorder. I was very aware that this was an eating disorder, but I was fighting like hell to not admit it and not allow what these loved ones and these people around me were saying to, I got defensive. The biggest reason I got defensive is because I didn't want them to take away the one thing that made me feel calm. The one tool in my tool belt that helped me when I was panicking, when I didn't feel good, or when I was having anxiety. And you know, I grew up in a household too, in the time period where medication was just shunned and like, ooh, we're not taking medication and meds are bad. So I'd never tried anything, like literally not even taken anything for pain, for balancing out my chemical imbalance, even though it'd been talked about with a few doctors of like, hey, why don't you? And I'm like, no. So I went into counseling like this. I sat there like you try to take away my running shoes and my protein balls and we're done. Like and it was, I had the best treatment team. It was awesome. They really were patient with me. I was eager to learn, and I knew I wanted to get better, but I was also scared out of my mind because I truly thought without my behaviors, I was not going to be able to make it. I literally thought my heart would explode. I was like, you guys, I will die if I don't have this. And my sweet counselor looked at me, she said, Brooke, this eating disorder is killing you. She's like, you're not dying because you don't have it. You're dying because you continue to hold on to it when we have to find some different ways to help you cope with life.
Yeah.
And for me, it was medication. And so I got on medication. I went to a treatment center in North Carolina. I'm from Georgia. So I went to a treatment center in North Carolina because they didn't have one for my age and stage in Georgia at the time. If you think about it, this is crazy, but I was literally the oldest person in the treatment center.
Really?
Yes, it was. There was a house that I was in and there were 16 girls. I was the oldest. I was the only one that was married, and there was one other sweet girl that had a baby, but I was basically the only one that was raising kids and had a full-time job and all this stuff. So I walked in there and I was like, what am I doing? I'm with these girls, right? I'm a woman.
Yeah.
They're like, I felt all sorts of layers and levels of shame that I like, even on top of that, of like, wow, like this, I let it get this far.
Yeah.
But they helped me. They helped me understand that, thank God that I came, because in actuality, do you know that most people suffer from eating disorders between the age of 45 and 65 now?
Really?
There's a few.
Wow.
I would say to that, my opinion, obviously not a doctor, but I think it's honestly that toxic mindset that of aging is bad.
Yeah.
We shouldn't age, which is so stupid.
Yeah. It's a natural process, right?
Like,
it's, you know.
And oh my gosh, my biggest, literally my biggest trigger, I've gotten to where I can handle anything and I can politely talk about anything with this stuff. But when people are comparing themselves, like, oh, well, I weighed this in high school, or I looked like this in high school. My favorite response is, I was 6 pounds when I was born.
Right. Yeah.
Do I want to be that now? Is that healthy? Is that appropriate now?
Yeah, no. not unless you have a Benjamin Button thing going.
And thank God you don't, because good.
Right. Right.
I don't know. This is my hot topic right now. With aging is a beautiful gift.
Yeah.
That many don't get.
Yeah.
I almost didn't get it. And I guess that's why I'm so positive now, is because I was so close. I was closer to death than I realized. When I actually got into treatment and started fueling myself, and just a brief thing, because eating disorder treatment, I know even my mom, when I told her, hey mom, I'm going to eating disorder treatment, she said, what do you do there? Sit around and eat? And I was like, love my mom. No, yeah. Mom, it's a little more than that, right? And my family members were confused. They were like, what are you going to do at eating disorder treatment? So to give you just a brief kind of rundown, it's a lot about having consistency, having balance, having routine, having accountability, and having a safe space to experience all the emotions and feelings that come with breaking lifelong habits, and having professionals that are there to walk you through and hold your hand through it. So eating disorder treatment, at least where I went, at the Carolina House, it's a great place. We would basically do the same thing every day. You wake up at 7, shower, get to breakfast. You would sit down, make your plate, eat your breakfast together, go do some mindful walking or, you know, journaling or something. And then you'd eat a midday snack. And then you'd go to do your different type of classes, DBT or learning about body image, blah, blah, blah. And then you go to lunch, then you go to snack, then you go to dinner, then you go to snack, then you go to bed, which sounds very monotonous and routine. But
that's kind of the idea, right? To get conditioned to that, it has to be a little bit monotonous, right?
And you have to think about it this way. My daughter is thriving and in a play right now. And she came to me yesterday and she was so overwhelmed with, oh my gosh, I have to learn all these lines. And it's like, yes, but we can't look at it like this because this is scary and this is something that is unattainable. But if we look at it like this, and then we can take it bit by bit by bit. And so I guess for the people listening to podcasts, this and this is not very descriptive. My apologies.
Well, you know, this taking, is video
how
too,
do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time, right?
Right, right.
So it really is like that for somebody that's healing from years and years of trauma connected with food and body and your relationship with like the consumption of food, the exercise, what food it does for your body. Like it's really, I feel like I took a college course on how to love myself, how to feed myself, and how to look at my emotions and feelings and my body. And also, if I do that, then project it onto everyone else around me, then I'm creating this beautiful life. And that's what treatment taught me is in that monotonous, like, build up that, okay, every time I sat down to meal, it was a little less scary, little less daunting, little less painful. And I think anybody that's suffering from any sort of addiction, going to treatment is like somebody telling you you're worth saving, like you're worth, you are a worthy human as you are, no matter what this is. Like your soul is what makes you worthy of love and respect on this planet. Nothing else. Not your education level, not what you look like, not. And it's like, once I accepted that about myself, I feel that way about everything and everyone around me now. It's interesting. And I've thought often about where my animosity used to come from, or my hatred towards people that I was jealous of or whatever. And it's like, that came from, I didn't love myself. There's no way I could admit that somebody else was beautiful and had that specialness in them, because that would mean I was below them. You know, because I felt below everyone, because that's where I put myself. So I think really treatment gave me the space and the time to heal. It was really hard.
I'm sure.
And the hardest part was being away from my kids. My kids and my husband. I was there for 7 weeks and I didn't see my kids the entire time. But I do want to say this. I went because of my children. I don't think I got to that part of the story. I kind of jumped, but when I knew I needed to go to eating disorder treatment was when I saw my children using the same behaviors as me. This same language as me, having the same anxieties around food, around exercise. It was, my son was 4 years old and showing signs of anorexia.
Wow.
And it was a learned behavior. He saw me fear food. And so he developed this fear for it as well. And when I saw, and when his principal, his little preschool principal came to me and said, hey, like, I need to talk to you about this. And I just broke. And he's like, so I went, and I went for them, but I came out for me.
Yeah. And I think it's like, thank you for sharing that, because I think that brings up two important points that are often overlooked when it comes to eating disorder. One, it can rub off even on a child so small, right? That's number one. Number two, you said it rubbed off on your son. So many people assume that it's only a female thing when that's clearly not, maybe the, obviously the numbers are greater in females because there's a lot more pressure on them by society, by everyone to look a certain way. So certainly it is more women than men, but certainly it's not as if men don't have it, even as you mentioned, a four-year-old, you know, grabbing onto those tendencies. So,
you know, I'll tell you a quick story because I think it is the most, one of the most important things is that eating disorders do not affect, and I completely own, I am a white woman living in a thin privileged body that's saying this, fully own that, but it doesn't only affect people that look like me or yeah. women in general. One of the saddest days I ever had in treatment, when I was at the PHP level, I was sitting in group one day, it was early morning, I was the first one there, and all of a sudden this young man comes in, and again, for age reference, I was 31, 32 at the time, and he comes in, and he was a younger guy, and I could tell, and he sat down across from me, we were the only two people in this big room, and I could tell it was his first day. He was bouncing, nervous, leg going up and down, just totally in a shell.
Yeah.
And I had been there before. I knew what that felt like. And so I kind of went over and sat next to him, introduced myself, and we started having a conversation. I was like, it's your first day, isn't it? Like, it's not bad. I know it seems bad now, but this is the best thing you're doing for yourself, giving him the old pump up.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm afraid I'm going to be the only guy here. And I said, you know what? You might be. I said, but so what? I was like, you're wanting to get help. You're wanting to be here. And yeah. And he shared that day it ended up just being me and him in the group class all day, which I think was a God thing for him because he needed that. And he ended up confiding in me a lot. But one thing he said to me is he said that he was a wrestler in high school. And he said, I then went to wrestle in college. I was taught how to make weight in high school, which if you don't know what that means in wrestling, they have to commit in a certain weight range that they have to be. And if they don't get to that weight range before the weigh-in time, then you don't get to wrestle.
Right.
So we won't even go into that, but these kids, they are taught by coaches, other kids, how to manipulate those scales on the day of. And he told me, he's like, everybody else that I know could just purge that way once or do it just for weight. He said, I can't stop. He's like, what's wrong with me? Why can everybody else, all my other guy friends, why can they just do these things and just go on with their everyday life? But why am I the one sitting here? And I just hugged him. And we had learned in a class just the day before, and this is an interesting way to put it, that with addiction, which eating disorders are basically learned behaviors and coping mechanisms, and also very physical part of eating disorders can be very addictive. People don't realize you can get addicted to physicality, physical things. And so we got it described like this. If you give 100 people, okay, doesn't matter, guy, girl, old, young, whatever. You give 100 people 5 Cokes and 2 candy bars every day for this is, well, I didn't want to use the beer example because I thought that might be. So you give somebody 5 Cokes and 2 candy bars every day for 90 days, every day.
Yeah.
Out of, then on the 90th day, done. No more Coke and candy bars. Take them away. 95 of those people would be like, okay, whatever. I'll eat something else. But 5 of those people are going to be like, but I have 5 Cokes and 2 candy bars. Why didn't, like,
why can't I have my Cokes and candy bars, but we have this every day. It's that, that addictive gene, that genetic component that some people cannot do a restriction or purging or anything. And I'm even talking, I'm not saying in unhealthy ways. No one should do any of that in unhealthy ways, but I'm talking even like religiously, I can't fast. Even if my religion calls for it, or if I want to participate in something like that, it is something I cannot do. And God and I have a understanding that me giving up something for 40 days would turn into a whole snowball of, let's see how much I can get away with, you know, and that's okay. And so I told him, I was like, listen, you're wired different and that's okay. And I do want to talk about the things that I have gained in recovery. I have gained my brain back. Like, I can think about other things besides food and exercise. I can connect with people. I never, I'm going to be telling on myself. So sorry, my old school, but at my old school, like, I was going through the motions. I didn't feel like I was contributing to my faculty and staff because I was sitting here just in a daze all day, just thinking about in my brain, either an eating disorder behavior or what I was going to do, how I was going to get it, where I was going to, it's, you know, like an addict thinking about their next fix. That's literally what my brain was for about 10 years. And I have been in recovery since 2016. It has not been perfect. I've had
slips. Of course not. Yeah.
I always like to say that because I think it's when you see somebody that's just thriving, like, oh, that's like rainbows and sunshines. You're like, well, that's never going to be me.
I don't think that's anybody, honestly. If it comes across that way, especially these days on social media, it's a mask, folks.
Yep.
That's like, it's
a mask.
That's
a filter. That's not how you look.
Yeah.
So no filter here. I've had gone down ups and downs, but there's a poem. It's a recovery poem about going down a different road. And it really does. Every time I have slipped, every time I have wanted or thought that it was a good idea to go back to one of those behaviors to calm an emotion, it's easier to get back on track because I realize how far I've come and what I want in life and how me being consumed by the disordered thoughts about exercise, food, and my body, like, I'm just not going to be able to live in the space and enjoy what I've worked so hard to create.
Right.
And what others have worked so hard to create. Shout out to my parents. Like, I tell them all the time, they're amazing people. They have been so supportive of my journey of needing to talk about this because it's not easy for them to hear. And my family's closer than we've ever been because I have taken off the mask and I'm not pointing fingers anymore. I'm saying this is on me. Like, yes, I've had traumas. Yes, I've had things that were not my fault, that I did not choose, that I had no way of controlling. My DNA, like, I have no way of controlling that, but to sit here and be angry about it and blame, that's getting me nowhere but sitting in a pity pot that I don't want to be in. Like, I want to experience life. So my biggest thing that I've gained is, ownership of self and in a way that I'm so proud of. Because it's I no longer idolize things about me that are superficial. I know we had talked about when off air that you wanted to also ask about ways we can support people that have eating disorders as caregivers. This is a big deal for me because my family were such amazing rock stars with me. Without my family, I would not have been able to recover, even at age 31, without the support of my husband and my parents and even my kids. Without everyone's support, I wouldn't have been able to heal. So the best thing I can say for families is to ask questions. Don't accuse.
Right.
I think that so often we see a loved one suffering. We see them using these behaviors that are detrimental, that are killing them, these addictions, these, you know, my husband had to watch me walk out the door and go on a run when I literally, my heart was dying. He couldn't restrain me from going and no one was going to stop me. It's what I was going to do. And you can't stop somebody, but you can stop them from ruminating by asking them questions. Like, instead of, you shouldn't go on a run today. Why are you running? You're so stupid. Blah, blah, blah. You're going to die. Like, sit down. What you feeling? Why do you feel like we need to go on a run right now? Like, what is... And like, take a check in your body. What's your body feeling like? Where are you feeling this anxiety? How is it presenting itself to you? Or even simple, just how are you doing today? Is there something bothering you? I see the joy and I really, really, really want to stress this, especially with talking with somebody that is suffering from body image dysmorphia, eating disorder. Make it about their soul and their being. Don't make it about their looks.
When you went into treatment, and this is for, I'm asking this for any, I'm not a parent myself, but for any parents who are listening, what did you tell your kids when, how did you explain that to them?
I'm so glad you asked that question. Number one, we're not as sneaky as we think. our children, regardless, 2, 4, 18, 48, I don't care who it is, you're not fooling as many people as you think you are. Yeah. So I would caution, well, I'll say this. My recovery goal was to be as honest as possible with everyone around me so I could have the space to heal without fearing the judgment around me. My kids were 2 and 4 at the time when I went. And of course, my 4-year-old, he's kind of next level thinker. He's like his mama. He knew everything was going on and obviously was picking up on my bad habits. And my 2-year-old was a little less aware, but I set them down and we said that mommy is going away to go to a place where she's going to learn. It's on, and we called it like school. I was like, it's like a, basically a college, a school where I'm going to go learn how to love myself properly so I can love you properly. Mm-hmm. And that's all I said. I just wrote a book. It's called Protecting Her Peace. And it's basically my story in fictional form.
Right.
And I say fictional form because that's what I needed when I was going to recovery. There's so many amazing firsthand account memoirs talking about healing and recovery and addiction and body image and eating disorders, so much wonderful information. What I was looking for was not a specific human that had specific kind of roles and things in life, because that was always an excuse for me to, oh, she could do it because of this, this, and this. I'm not like her. She could do it, or he could do it because of this, this, and this. I'm not like him. I have this, this, and this. And I realized as a literature person that the reason we connect with characters so much in books is because they're not real people. There's always this possibility that we have this connection with this fictional, this character, that it's possibility. Characters are possibilities. If you would like to order it, it is on Amazon, it's on Barnes & Noble, and it's also an ebook, so Kindle.
Yeah.
And it's called Protecting Her Peace. And
if you could go back and talk to the younger Brooke when she was struggling, what would you say to her now?
That you are made of River Runoff, Stardust, and Prometheus Fire, and don't let anyone tell you different.
Love it. I love that. I love that answer.
You are it. Don't let anyone tell you different.
All right. Well, Brooke, this has been such a special episode, and thank you for being this open with your story. I'm sure that it's obviously going to resonate with a lot of people who have eating disorders, but I can tell you, as I was listening to you, anybody struggling, there's so many similar symptoms out there. I have clinical depression. I've been in therapy for a few years now, and I could relate to many of the things you were saying, even though I've never had an eating disorder, but just that symptoms and feeling like a burden and all those struggles, I could relate. So thank you for being so open.
Well, yeah. Neil, thank you.
All right. Well, have a good day.
We'll talk soon. I'll email you.
We will. Definitely. All right. Bye.
Bye.